Upfront, inside Atlanta's entertainment industry, is brought to you by Atlanta's Jazz Station, 91.9 FM, WCLK.
Coming up on this week's show, Dr. Ayanna Van Zandt is here to chat about her new series, Fear Not, airing tonight on the Oprah Winfrey Network. Singer Keisha Jackson and WCLK's Jamal Achmed are here to pay tribute to the lives of music giants Andre Harrell, Betty Wright, and Little Richard. All three passed away last weekend. My last segment, The Show Must Go On, Entertainment and COVID-19, examines the pandemic's impact on Atlanta's theater community. Jamil Jude, artistic director for Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater Company, is here, along with noted playwright and director Thomas W. Jones. I'll also be playing music from Motown's musical genius Stevie Wonder, who turned 70 years old this week. Today's show is also dedicated to the memory of WCLK personality and Jazz Tones announcer Jay Edwards and artist extraordinaire Louis Del Sarte. But first, here's an important message from WCLK.
This is an important message from the CDC about coronavirus. With coronavirus spreading, we must all act now to slow it down, taking care of ourselves and not putting others in harm's way, especially those already at risk, including people over 65 or those with serious underlying medical conditions. To help stop the spread of coronavirus, avoid crowded areas and stay home if you can. If you must be out, stay 6 feet or two arms lengths away from others and wash up after being in public spaces. Even if you're not at high risk, these steps should be taken to help stop the spread of coronavirus. We need to stay apart, but we're all in this together. Visit coronavirus.gov for the latest information from the CDC. This message made possible by the Ad Council and WCLK.
This is Ayanna Van Zandt, and you're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius.
My first segment features teacher, motivational speaker, author, and thought leader, Dr. Ayanna Van Zandt. The Fix My Life star is back with a new limited series on the Oprah Winfrey Network titled Fear Not. The show, which is part of OWN's Sisterhood Saturday Nights, features Van Zandt offering her guidance during the pandemic, along with special guests, gospel music icon Bebe Winans, and financial educator Tiffany Bajanista Alice. I caught up with Dr. Van Zandt during this week's roundtable press junket, where she explained how the show was inspired by a late night conversation with Oprah Winfrey.
She really felt that it was a time when we had an opportunity to share with people, to support people, because so many of us are having the same concerns, the same issues, particularly when you look in the communities of color. And when we talked about it, I just had a very different take on what was going on and what people needed to do. So she asked me if I would do it. And when your boss asks you to do something, you do it.
Dr. Van Zandt went on to further explain that our mandatory time of being shut in is actually the perfect time to go in and work on ourselves.
I find it so interesting that everything we had come to value and worship in this society was shut down. Athletes, shut down. Entertainers, shut down. Big corporate jobs with big corporate titles, shut down. Being able to run out and fill our voids and our emotional emptiness with products and things and food, shut down. Everything that took us away from the essence and the truth of who we are was shut down. And we kind of, many people missed the message, go in. They said stay home, but they didn't say go in. Go in and really get clear. So if your job is gone and you don't go back to being the VP of such a much, what you gonna do? Who you gonna be? And if, you know, your job doesn't come back and you have to give up your car or downsize, who you gonna be? What you gonna do? And if you don't have the money or your whatever it is, what you gonna do? What are the athletes gonna do? when people can't see them and they aren't in the thrill of the crowd and know what they're gonna do? Are they just athletes? So these are not questions and things that were not important before the corona hit. It's just that the corona has provided us with the opportunity to handle our business. Take care of your business. See, I'm gonna be Yama Van Zandt if I don't ever show up on another TV screen, if I never get to shoot another TV show, if I have to leave this house and go live in a tent in the park with the squirrels, I'm gonna be Yama Van Zandt. And I'll find some way to late night snack. And I'll be all right.
Fear Not with Ayanna Van Zandt airs tonight at 9 p.m. on OWN.
Jazz 91.9 WCLK stands with the Rialto Center for the Arts. The Rialto Center stands with WCLK. During these difficult times, we're all in this together, even if we must be apart. Up-to-date information about the Rialto Center for the Arts plan for the future is available at rialto.gsu.edu. Stay in touch. Keep listening to Jazz 91.9 WCLK.
Make sure you're satisfied, and there's no hard thing to the joy I'll bring. I wanna give you all my love. That's all I wanna do. Every day and every hour, baby.
This is Omar Dorsey, aka Hollywood of Queen Sugar, and you're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius.
That was music from the Queen of Hip Hop Soul, Mary J. Blige, performing her classic tune, Love No Limit. She is just one of the many artists mourning the death of famed music executive Andre Harrell. The founder of Uptown Records passed away last weekend, along with beloved R&B singer-songwriter Betty Wright and the architect of rock and roll, Little Richard. Here to celebrate their legacies are Soul of Jazz host Jamal Ahmed and Betty Wright's goddaughter and singer, Keisha Jackson. Check out a portion of our conversation.
When you think about Andre Harrell, you have to talk about an individual who really served as a bridge for generations. I mean, the thing that he even said was when he left Def Jam that he wanted to get into the R&B game, but he wanted to do it from the perspective of the young hip-hopper at that time, which is about 1986, 1987, who's deeply entrenched listening to LL Cool J and Run DMC. So it's like, how can you do R&B right after that? So then comes New Jack Swing and the Teddy Riley movement, and you saw the movement with I'll Be Sure. You saw all the things that he did to really create this new sophisticated kind of fusion for young R&B talent, you know, so they could actually exist in a world that was being driven towards hip-hop.
And you
look at all the people that he nurtured, from, like you said, Mary J. to Jodeci, to Heavy D, to Teddy Riley, to God. This is the soundtrack of anyone who came up in the 80s and 90s. This is the soundtrack of your youth. So Andre Harrell, also you have to remember, is one of those individuals that really represented the black, you know, music executive, you know, that new generation of the executive, because he was right after Gerald Busby. Gerald Busby put him on, actually, along with Clarence Avon. He came after that era and kind of extended it towards people like Puffy. So if there was no Andre Harrell, you wouldn't have had a Puffy or Diddy, whatever you want to call them. Yeah, you would not have that brother.
Yeah. And he also spent some time at Motown as well, which I think, you know, as you're talking about those music executives, you think about a Berry Gordy, you think about a Clive Davis, who was able to not only discover talent, they were able to nurture that talent and really produce some amazing, amazing music.
Yeah, and also, I'm glad you said that, Ray, because sonically, when you really pay attention to what they were doing at Uptown Records and taking those classic hip-hop break beats and putting, like, R&B over it, you know, no one had done that before. No one had given us those Stevie Wonder chords over an old James Brown sample.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and Keisha, you know, she was in the midst of all of that. So she, as an artist, can definitely relate to his influence.
I met Andre on occasion. You know, I can't say I knew him, but, you know, I was in the same space multiple times, you know, especially with Outkast. And me actually coming from New York, initially my, you know, my musical influence was from the North, you know, until I moved south when I did my record and stuff like that. But Andre was just so heavily embedded in everything. You know, when you think about even like New Jack Swing is kind of when I came out with my stuff, but being from New York, like you couldn't do anything without going through Andre. You know what I mean? And he was such a beautiful person, you know, as far as I knew, but he was so iconic in that everyone knew who he was. Everyone, like people revered him like the previous generation revered Clarence Avon.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? And so it was really refreshing to have that mentorship, that person that had so much knowledge. You wanted him to approve of what you were doing, even if he had nothing to do with it. You wanted to get the nod or get the okay from him, even if he had nothing to do with the project. Because if he greenlit it, you knew it was okay.
When I finally got a melody, I took it home and I played it for my mother. I gotta tell you a little bit about my mother. You see, I come from one of those pretty large families, and I'm the baby of the family. You know, you never grow up to your mother. I'll never forget the way she looked at me when I played it for her. She said, I like the music. You know, baby, the melody is really nice.
Keisha, let's talk about your godmother, Miss Betty Wright, who, again, like I said, was one of the voices to come out of the 70s. And she made a smooth transition right into the 80s, creating songs and a sound that I think, with so many artists, once you heard it, you knew that that was her. You know what I mean? You knew that that was her.
Yeah.
It was a Betty Wright song. And just really being able to connect with her female audience and her male audience. So let's talk about, if we can, the Betty Wright sound.
Betty Wright is, you know, very instrumental in the, you know, the soul sound of Miami. You know, and with the label that she was with at that time. I mean, you know, people don't realize that, like, the stuff that she was, that you remember her by, the stuff that made her career, like, she was 15 years old. You know what I mean? You just, when you listen back to those records now, you still don't, I mean, it's really hard even for me to go, what kind of a 15-year-old has that kind of a voice? You know what I mean? Like, it was gutsy and it was everything. They don't realize that Betty was there during the Miami riots. They don't realize that when it comes to the Miami sound, she was instrumental in that sound period, and not just in soul music, but putting soul in the Latino music. You know what I'm saying? They didn't realize that, like, the Miami sound machine was very much driven by a Betty Wright. You know, people just don't realize. People don't realize that when it came to, do you guys remember when Gloria Estefan got into that really horrible accident on her bus, and she came back with her coming out of the dark? It was Betty Wright. You know what I mean? Betty Wright was her vocal coach, and Betty Wright nursed her and worked her voice back. And that's why on the, I don't remember if it was the Grammys or the American Music Awards, but Betty was there, you know, with the choir, and because she was very instrumental in that, and Gloria wouldn't have it any other way. So the Miami sound machine, not the group, but the machine of Miami, is very much Betty Wright.
Let's talk about the architect of rock and roll, Little Richard. And I remember meeting him a couple of years back. It was the, it was the Atlanta Tribune's Hall of Fame, and he was one of the recipients that year. And when he came into the room, it was just like, wow, this is Little Richard. I mean, it was just, I had never seen him or met him before in person. And it was just, I was amazed. And he was every bit of the star that he said that he was,
yes.
You know, when you got a chance to meet him. So if we can, Jamal, you know, when they were basically kind of showing him on the news, you know, the thought came to mind of just how so many great artists have come out of the red clay of Georgia. You know, you look at him, you look at James Brown, you look at Gladys Knight, so many folks that really define
Ray Charles.
Yeah, Ray Charles, the soul music sound. Can we talk about Little Richard being, and he was different. I mean, all of them were different, but I mean, Little Richard was really different from the others. So can we talk about just how he really stood out and really opened the door for other artists like himself?
Yeah, Ray. You know, when you think about Little Richard, and you think about Georgia, like you said, Georgia has been very integral in creating not only brilliant artists, but artists who have been very pivotal in the genre. I mean, we just lost Hamilton Bohannon 2 weeks ago. And Hamilton Bohannon is the reason you had disco and house music and electronic music. So, you know, Georgia has always been that. But Little Richard, in my opinion, of course, and I think everyone's opinion, really is like that big star, you know, at the top of the tree when it comes to those artists from Georgia who impacted it. Because Little Richard, people forget that he was a bridge too, just like we would say with Andre Harrell. He was a bridge from the old R&B jazz sound of the 30s and 40s. He took that and kind of created this new thing that they had to create called rock and roll. They created the name rock and roll because of racial issues. Right. But we all know that Little Richard was playing blues. He was playing jazz. He was playing rhythm and blues. Gospel. He was playing gospel. Exactly. He came from that rich tradition of black music. And you think about Little Richard's impact, the fact that the Beatles all started playing Little Richard songs. So you wouldn't have the Beatles without Little Richard. Jimi Hendrix was in his band.
Sure was.
You know, so he nurtured so many people, and Elvis and Jerry Lewis and all of them looked up to Little Richard. And I remember being a kid, and you know, I think we all kind of saw Little Richard in that 80s era when he was always at the award show saying, ain't nobody gave him nothing.
I am going to fix Chuck Berry. I am going to upset his nerve and let him know that I am the king of rock and roll, the undisputed king, and can't nothing take my throne. I am going to show him that he is from the valley and not from the mountain. Chuck Berry know that I was a star, been a star all my life. He can't close no show behind me. How can he have the nerve, the audacity to walk on? I'm Little Richard. Chuck Berry, they built him over me all these years, 23 years in show business. I'm the creator, the originator, the emancipator. I am the one.
As we got older, we understood that he really didn't get what he deserved. He actually was absolutely correct in saying all of that. And I'm glad he stood up for himself, because
me too.
A lot of artists stood up for themselves, and people try to say he was a character, but no, he was just standing up for not only himself, but a lot of black artists who didn't get the justice that they deserve.
And people don't understand that he started doing what he's so fearless. So fearless. He started doing what he was doing in terms of, you know, the makeup and the hair and all of that stuff, because he came up in an era when, you know, white people would not allow black artists to perform in front of their women.
Right.
Because they were intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he dressed up and put makeup on and put on a wig, he was less intimidating. And he did that in order to create a platform himself and to get himself and his music out there and to make them feel safe. You feel what I'm saying? And so there would be no, it's like you said, Rolling Stones. There would be, you know, so many, the genre would not exist without him, period.
Watch the full conversation with Jamal Ahmed and Keisha Jackson at WCLK.com.
If it's magic, then why can't it be everlasting? Like the sun that always shines, like the poet's endless rhyme, like the galaxies and time.
This is Coleman Domingo, and you're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius.
My last segment is part of an ongoing series, The Show Must Go On, Entertainment and COVID-19. This week focuses on Atlanta's theater community and how it has been impacted by the coronavirus. Many theater companies around the city have been shut down for the last 2 months, leaving performers and patrons to question if we'll ever enjoy live theater again. Joining me for the first part of the conversation is Jamil Jude, Artistic Director for Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater Company. He was in between productions when the coronavirus closed the curtain on his inaugural season.
We were lucky in the fact that we just finished Schoolgirls of the African Mean Girls play, our run of Jocelyn Bio's show. So that play closed on the 8th of March. And I would say that I realized this thing was serious probably the following Wednesday when the NBA shut down. I actually happened to be in Denver, Colorado. I was working at the Denver Center on a production of Choir Boy. So I was actually doing my freelance work when I found out about, just this news and how it was going to affect us. We're thankful at True Colors that we haven't had to furlough any of our staff or anything like that because we weren't in production. So the bulk of our expenses are production related. So right now we're able to, thanks for, you know, the support of individuals and corporations and foundations, we've been able to kind of live off general operating money to pay our staff. But we have had to postpone our summer production of Maria and Rosetta, which was scheduled to begin rehearsal this week, actually. Wow. Yesterday. Yeah.
Wow. And so this is you've been with the company for a couple of years, but this is your first full season as artistic director. Yeah. So what a way to start, well, not start, but just, this is a really big deal for your very first season. So you, as the leader of this company, how have you just been able to navigate through this?
Well, I think a thing I'm comforted in is that I am not the only person in this situation, right? Like, it is not something that has just befallen True Colors. It's affected everybody across the world. And there are so many other artistic leaders in the nation who are in their first year. We've actually been meeting over Zoom, kind of commiserating, sharing best practices and things like that. So that's been very helpful. I think what I feel most is that I feel a responsibility to my staff that works really, really hard. I understand that the decisions that I'm making at all the time, but definitely in this moment, affect their ability to have a paycheck, to feed their families, to live a life. Chandra Stevens Albright, my managing director, has been amazing. So I want to shout her out as well. But I think what's been really great is that we've really upped our creativity. I think in the moment, that in March, we all were like, yo, what is this? How long will this last? And we were very just struck by it all. But I would say in April, maybe late March, early April, we just started putting our heads together. Like, hey guys, how can we be proactive? Let's stay connected to our communities. Let's live out our mission. Let's really thrive. If we say that we thrive at the intersection of artistic excellence and civic engagement, what does that look like in the age of Corona? When we know that our patron base, our audience is, 90% Black on an off day, and they're being negatively affected by this virus, what are the things that we can do as a theater company to stay engaged? So we started the True Colors podcast series. We moved forward with our community conversation that's happening on Saturday, the 18th of May. The 17th of May, excuse me. We're really looking forward to just staying connected through this digital platform, True Colors. We can't sit back and just wait. That would be a waste of the resources our community has entrusted us with. So that's how we're trying to stay engaged. But it's a trip, and I have to give myself grace like everyone else should. I think everyone involved in this should continue to give ourselves grace. We are not working from home. We are trying to manage our lives in the midst of a pandemic, and we are all doing it while we're trying to stay safe at our home.
Noted playwright and director Thomas W. Jones also joined in on the conversation and was optimistic about the use of virtual technology and reimagining theater. We also discussed how the AIDS pandemic of the early 80s might also have some valuable lessons for us in this new age of Corona.
So I think as a community, I think what we're going to have to begin dealing with is how do we engage audiences and allowing the technology to solve it? Which is there's nothing like coming to the live theater. That's going to always be sacrosanct. That's always going to be an experience that you can't replicate. But are there other ways in which we have a user experience with the theater that are equally as engaging? What if I could put on glasses and enter into the virtual world of a play as one of its characters, which they're already doing? There's a piece called The Raven, based on Edgar Allan Poe, where there's that interactive experience. We do it in video games all the time. Is there a way to engage theaters in that way? Can we e-commerce that so that maybe if you have to downsize an audience because of social distancing, you can still have people participate in the world of that play via their homes? Is that a new subscription model? Is there a new marketing model to audiences that have been disaffected, seniors, not simply busing them to a theater, but allowing them to be wherever they exist? Disaffected populations, school kids, can we now bring the virtual world of theater into the classroom in a way that they don't have to come to the theater? Those are ways I think that we can allow the technology to solve issues of audience engagement that we were having before the pandemic, that has now simply been exacerbated because of the pandemic. Those are the things that I think universities are going to have to answer, which they are. You know, what does the new classroom look like? What Right. does the new theater look like? Are we experiencing, and part of what I wouldn't say, I was reluctant to say, has the industry died to some degree, and is something going to have to be reborn in its place? Mm. Has the not-for-profit model that we all experienced, that got revolutionized in the 60s, the theater movement, by asking some really fundamental questions of, can theater exist outside of New York in a substantive way? And the answer to that was the regional theater movement. Has the pandemic not forced us to ask the same seismic question? Has the prior model of what the regional theater looked like, is that now obsolete? Do we have to reinvent that now for a new age, given the fact that we can't convene in the way that we used to?
I want to go back some years. This is not your first time at the rodeo and dealing with the pandemic. You actually went through the HIV/AIDS pandemic that ravished the theater community and Broadway community in the early 80s. Are there some lessons that we can learn from that pandemic that we can use now during this current corona storm that we're in right now?
Absolutely. I think there are tremendous similarities and obviously some differences, some fundamental differences. The major thing is to not be ruled by fear and paranoia. That a lot of what happened where we shut ourselves away from each other in the 80s because of not having enough information about HIV/AIDS, how it was transmitted, what were the, you know, the repercussions of it, we began to shun people away. We began to stop dealing with our neighbors and our friends and our artists because of our fear. And the more we learned, and I think Magic Johnson was really helpful in that at a certain point to be able to say, you can get it, this is how you get it, and let's talk about, have a national conversation about what it means to live with AIDS and what it is to live, you know, in a community and working in partnership with each other, so that we dispel the mythology and can deal with fact-based, you know, and what the truth of it was. The difference, I mean, fundamentally was once we could get over the fear, the whole world didn't shut down in a certain type of its industry because of it. People were still able to go to work. There were people still going to the theaters. There were still people going to movie houses. We didn't stop having to live life as we knew it because we were there. We had to just overcome the fear of how it was transmitted.
Watch the full conversation of The Show Must Go On, Entertainment and COVID-19 at WCLK.com. And tune in next week for my interviews with Broadway performers Quentin Earl Darrington and Lamar Baylor and how COVID-19 has impacted their future careers in theater. Well, that'll do it for this week's show. I'd like to thank all of my special guests, Keisha Jackson, Jamal Ahmed, Jamil Jude, Thomas W. Jones, and Dr. Ayala Van Zandt. I'd also like to thank my engineer, Jami Wellman, and you. Please join us next week for another exciting edition of Upfront, Inside Atlanta's Entertainment Industry. Happy Saturday, Atlanta.
If you like today's show, please hit us up at WCLK.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Upfront, Inside Atlanta's Entertainment Industry has been brought to you by Atlanta's Jazz Station 91.9 FM WCLK, an NPR member-supported station.